And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025, and I'm now here with The Woodlander. The Woodlander has appeared, I think, most years for the last 5 years, and is well known to most of us. Do you think there's any need to give a brief introduction? I think the main thing is that you live in the woods and you have an initiative to buy up land, but why don't you give it in your own words?
I am the old man who lives in the woods. I live off grid. I built a cabin. A lot of people saw what I was doing, became interested. Mostly on the right, surprisingly, because what I'm doing is has usually been the preserve of the left. But it's grown from there into the Woodlander Initiative, which is going well. So yeah, I mean, that's it in a nutshell.
All right. And we'll get to the initiative later. Of course, you've talked about it in previous years, but we'll have an update on that in a while. But first, we're going to talk about some events in Britain this year, because you, I think, like me, think that this year has been actually pretty good and quite encouraging. There's room for optimism from this year. So obviously, I want to hear that so that it's not just me saying this stuff. And the first thing that you wanted to talk about was the Raise the Flags campaign. Now, again, just before you get started, some people dismissed this as a Fed PSYOP thing. I thought that it was genuine. At least I think it began genuinely. One of the guy who started it, I believe, got in touch with me to tell me that, you know, his background and that it was genuine, and he explained various things. And I think we can be too paranoid about getting involved and disparaging people who are doing things. I think it's very important that we don't do that without bloody good reason. So anyway, that all aside, what do you think about the Raise the Flags campaign?
I think it did start organically. And I'll be absolutely honest, I don't care if it got co-opted later down the road. And I've listened to the arguments that people put forward, and you know, that it's a PSYOP, it's been co-opted, all they want is for people to put these flags up and it doesn't achieve anything. That's completely wrong. It actually achieved a hell of a lot. The amount of people I know, right, that saw those flags from our side, and it gave an immense morale boost to them, and it was as much as the whole public have moved to the right. What that did was it put an identity with it. So it wasn't just a move to the right; it was a move with identity. People were saying, "This is England. This is Britain. This is ours." So it was belonging, and it doesn't matter if it was co-opted, right? It had the effect it was supposed to have. So and the public for certain weren't worried if it was co-opted or if it was a PSYOP, right? They saw it as patriotic, right, and that it was a good thing. The public got behind it. And that's the important thing. The majority of the public didn't see that as a negative. They saw it as a positive. So that swing we've had this year is the public saying, we've had enough, and actually pushing to the forefront, we have got an identity. This is ours. And that was the first time I've seen that large scale, when it's not involving football and it's not involving sport. It was just to say, this is us and this is ours. And the fact that the public got behind it was actually really, really good. And that's gone much further. Most people have been around a while, but I've been around probably longer than most on this side of things. I mean, I know you've had you had John Waters on the other night, who's, you know, he's older than me, and you had you've had people who are older, but who probably weren't right wing when they were younger. Most of them started off sort of liberal or left wing. I was always on the right from like pre-teens. So I've seen quite a lot of stuff, and I have never, ever, ever experienced what we've got now, which is MPs standing in the House of Commons demanding mass deportation of foreigners. Not just single MPs, but you've now got the Conservative Party and the Labour Party saying that they are both going to enact mass deportations of foreigners. That has never, ever happened before. Ever. It's just, it's an amazing point in our history where everyone is using our talking points. So that is huge. And I don't think people quite realise, and we're definitely not capitalising on it. Sadly, the only group out there that isn't really trumpeting it is the one that's likely to win the next general election, which is Reform. And Farage has been really, really weak on pushing for this. He's put caveats in every time he could. He's backed down to the Muslim problem in several interviews. There's been a lot of pressure, or apparent pressure, put on Farage recently by from things he said 50 years ago at school. And I tend to think that that could be that the people who know he's going to be in power realise that he's actually losing people because he's not hard enough. And I think what they've done is actually leaked these stories out there to boost his appeal, because that's the effect it's having. It's having the effect that people on the right are listening to him and he's so weak, but then these stories crop up and they think, well, maybe he is all right then. So it's a weird thing that actually those stories aren't doing him much harm at all. They're actually doing him a favour. So as much as I've been really, really encouraged with the way the public have moved, certainly to much further our direction, and I've also been encouraged with the split that is now obvious between ethno-nationalism and civic nationalism, the issue is the Reform Party. That's a big issue, because that's who we've got to be looking at going into the next election, who's probably going to win it. And I think we've got a problem.
We should just say, before you get onto that, this is all interesting. I think the only way that they won't win it is if there's a huge coalition between the awful leftist parties, Labour, Lib Dem, and the Greens, the newly energised Greens, who up till now were a total irrelevance across the country, except in Bristol or Brighton? I think it's Brighton.
Brighton.
Nowhere else was progressive enough to contemplate voting for the Greens. And the Greens are even increasing their progressiveness right now, at this moment in time when everyone else is going to the right. they're not just staying where they were. They've got this gay Jew in leading them now, who's saying that he would help migrants cross the channel.
Yeah. Oh no, it's insanity. But those people have to have somewhere to go.
But my point is that I think that's the only way that reform won't end up being the next government is if that happens. Other than that, reform are obviously going to win the next election unless something huge changes between now and then. So, yeah, I just wanted to lay that groundwork before you proceeded there.
No, I think you're dead right. And that is an obvious danger. But I just can't see it. I can't see the British public buying a three-way coalition between a Labour Party who is despised, the Greens who, they look ludicrous, they really do, apart from for the people that are in it. I can't see it. I think reform will sweep the board. Now, I know everybody says reforms, he's not our guy, it's not our party, but they're going to be obviously better than Labour. And I'm not sure about that. I'm really not. And as much as it, what it does do is it breaks the two-party system, which is a good thing. But not if you've put any hope in reform and Farage. And I think even our side, people are putting some hope in Farage and reform, thinking, well, it's going to be better. He's going to do something. I think when they get into power, the first thing to say is Farage is 100%. He's a system man. He all the way through, he's an ex-banker, city banker. He likes this system. He doesn't want to rock the boat. He wants to retain this system. He just wants to be at the top in it. He's not looking to make major changes. He never has been. He is going to tell the public exactly what he thinks they want to hear. And he's going to do nothing. Nothing at all. The problem I foresee with Farage is that he is a massive bully. And he cannot stand anybody who stands up against him. Or even if he thinks they might. We've seen what he does to people in his own party. What he did with Rupert Lowe was absolutely, I mean, that should really point to the kind of guy he is. I mean, he tried to have him imprisoned. He used every possible slur he could. He said he was violent, that he was attacking people, that he was suffering from dementia.
And was there not something about sexually harassing women as
well? Yeah.
I think there was.
Sexually and harassing violent, women in his office.
And violent to Zia, or intimidating Zia Yusuf, who's half his age. I mean, it's completely absurd. And then, indeed, the dementia thing. And what it was interesting about that, for our purposes here, is it was completely over the top. He did far more than he needed to. He could have just said, well, look, personality conflict. He's not a team player, wouldn't toe the line, whatever. And that's that. But instead, he launched a huge, like, multifaceted character assassination against the guy. And I think it's interesting. The thoroughness of it is, I think, is significant because it implies.
Well, if he acts like that to a person, we've got to look at his history. And we've got to look at now we see the type of guy he is. How do you think, let's say he doesn't do anything. He's a failure, right? He doesn't stop the small boats even, which I think he will, right? But that's not really going to make a dent on anything. So nothing really changes. And there's another atrocity or something happens and there's a protest. How do you think he's going to react? Because I can tell you, he's going to label people far right. He'll say, that is the far right. You know, I'm a proud, you know, I smashed the BNP and I'll smash this lot. And this guy will go twice as hard as Starmer to prove his point. That look at me, I'm in power. I am not the far right. I'm the sensible centrist. And he's going to go full on against us. There's going to be nothing. He's going to be worse because he's going to have to prove himself. He's the new kid on the block. He's already said he doesn't like the far right. We've seen what kind of guy he is. Reform, I think, could be the biggest mistake and the biggest hurdle we've ever come across for us. It doesn't bode well.
Yeah, there are echoes of Thatcher's government getting in and crushing the National Front because they're offering to do something, but it within a mainstream frame. So
I mean, Thatcher just, what happened there was she stole all of the talking points from the National Front, and knowing full well that the public were looking that direction, but are much more comfortable with a party that they already know, that's already been in power. So it was an easy swing to pull people from the National Front to the Tory Party. But then when they got into power, they actually did nothing about immigration at all. Nothing. So,
I actually, on that note, I wrote an essay this year called The Great Replacement, Is It Democratic? And I noted this. It's the first time I've actually studied this in detail, that the 70s was actually quite static for immigration. The 60s, there was actually, it was increasing year by year. The 70s was kind of a stasis. And then the first term of Thatcher's government, there was reduction of immigration. And then immediately, as soon as she got voted back in, it went up year after year after year, record-breaking highs almost every year of her prime ministership after that first term. So from 1983 onwards, it was just... and this is supposedly a hard-right government.
Yeah. And I think we're going to find the same with Farage. I don't think it's going to work out in our favour at all. Which begs the question, and there's a lot of reasons for it as well, which I'll touch on them. So, if immigration stays the same as it is now, and it's actually dropped, it's come down, okay? But if immigration stays roughly the same as it is now, and we look at things like AI, automation, and technology, and the effect that's going to have on employment, now, they reckon in the next 10 to 20 years, that's going to reduce employment by around 25%. That's a huge figure. But that's what everybody's saying, that especially automation, which is led by AI, is going to take away a quarter of employment in the next two decades. If immigration stays the same, those people aren't going to have jobs to go into. So they're going straight on to welfare. A lot of them do anyway, we know that. But you're also looking at 25% of the people already here going on to welfare. At that point, the welfare bill is rising exponentially. The tax income to the government is going down. And you've got a perfect storm insofar as welfare can't be paid anymore. And at that point, you've got a government that's either going to go bankrupt or going to have to make cuts which are going to send people into the streets. The minute they cut benefits, the minute they cut welfare to the level it's going to have to be cut, certain portions of our population are going to burn the cities to the ground. They will not stand for it. And I can't see how Farage is going to manage that situation. He's just not going to be able to manage it without bringing in a police state.
It would be ironic if a right winger, supposedly racist, and a long-time professed libertarian, ended up being the guy who does what you've described.
Yeah, I've always said I think things like ID cards, digital ID, and all of that will be brought in by a right-wing government, and I can see Farage implementing all of it in order to control the population. And in order to control the population, because things are going to get tough, the cost of living is going to continue to rise, that the welfare is going to have to be cut, immigration's going to continue at the same level roughly, you're going to end up with more diversity, more people. Everyone's going to be unhappy, and the only way you can do that is to control the population. Agenda 2030 covers all of those bases. What it does is it chops the population down to small, manageable areas, 20-minute areas, which are highly surveilled. The legislation's already in place. If you look at what's happening online, you've got the online safety bill, which curtails what you can say online. If you step outside of that, you're going to get busted. There's more arrests in the UK than there is in any other country for online speech. They've put in legislation now for protests. If you protest too hard about anything they don't want you to protest about, you'll be arrested. So the legislation's already there to control the population. We're the most highly surveilled country in the world. There's more CCTV cameras here than anywhere else. Everything is in place for a very, very dystopian future. Worryingly, I think people are pinning their hopes on the party, I think, that are going to bring it in. I think people are thinking Farage will be okay. And I think it's the only way he's going to be able to do anything is to implement all the things we don't want him to implement.
And of course, in amongst all of that, you've also got the abolition of jury trials. So yeah. you'll be judged and found guilty by some state apparatus.
That was brought up the other night. I think it is when you were talking to John, and the chat was saying much the same thing as what I thought, which is the abolition of jury trials is the first step to an AI court system, which is faster. And the argument they'll use is it takes out human infallibility. This thing, it just works purely on the facts. It can't be swayed one way or the other. It's quicker. It's more efficient. They're going to use this argument for everything. And it's difficult to argue against. The AI will simply look at your case, study the facts, and give you your sentence. Job done.
Yeah. It'll be a matter of nanoseconds.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It would be a lot cheaper and incredibly faster. But the thing is, as we know, AIs are not impartial. If it's built into the AI that far left violence, much less important, much less dangerous to society than far right violence, then it's going to find a certain way every single time, very reliably.
It's all about control. It has been for ages. It's just who's going to bring it in, how they're going to bring it in, and why they bring it in. But the infrastructure for that whole thing is now in place already. It's already there. I think once Farage has done a year or two large swathes of the population are going to be looking for a way out, because they'll see what's coming. They'll see that diversity hasn't reduced, it's increased. They'll see that their cost of living's going up, and they're either unemployed or their wages are stagnant. I'm seeing this now. I'm seeing people now who are saying to me, I haven't had a pay rise in 5 years. Yeah, I go to the shops and things are 10 times what they were 3 years ago. I went in, you know, just to buy a loaf of bread and some butter, and it cost me 20 quid. You know, by the time I got something to go in the sandwich, I'm 20 quid down on a sandwich. And it's getting to the point now where people, when's that going to change? And the minute it starts affecting businesses, which is, there's more small businesses going bust at the moment than at any other time. Pubs are closing every single day. It's not looking good moving forward. So as much as this year has been a massive boost for the way the public are thinking and the way the public are moving, which has been echoed by what the politicians are saying, and I've got to give credit as well to Steve Laws especially, and the team he's got around him, for pushing remigration. It was Martin Selner that came up with it, with the word. It is repatriation or mass deportations, but the word remigration now is in the public vocabulary. And to get it there and hear people on the fringes of the political parties talking about remigration is a massive push forward. So our radicals, our radical wing, which is what Steve is actually doing his job. He's pushing that window further and further, right, and clearing the land behind, which allows us movement, which allows us to move into it. So he's done a really good job. It's annoying when people knock the radicals, because we need them to push it. We need them to go further, right? Because it does clear the land behind them for us. And then we can start having conversations. And then we can start talking about things in the middle there. So, yeah, it's credit where credit's due. He's done incredibly well. But as much
yes,
as the public...
Yes, he has. I just want to back you up on that, because some people have asked why he's not appearing on Millennial this year. It's simply because he was on last year. That's the only reason. I don't want to create any more every year guests. It's a thing. It's just my own logistics. I can't do that anymore because there are so many people who need to appear. So that is the only reason that Steve Laws hasn't been invited on this year. But
Steve's getting on everywhere at the moment. The good thing is he's not backing down. He's not trying to go, okay, we'll walk it back a bit. He's doing exactly what a radical fringe should do. He's pushing on with the extreme, with the radicals. And that does clear open a space behind him to start having conversations. And we're seeing that now. So as much as the public has moved, as much as the politicians are talking our way, I have got to worry about what happens in 4 years' time, in 3 or 4 years' time. Farage worries me, and the infrastructure that's been put in place, he's going to use. He's not going to get rid of this stuff. He's going to use it, and he's going to use it to control the public. And if you look at his history, the people he's most proudest of putting down is the far right. So I think we need to be very wary of Farage. This is why I've been such a big proponent of parallel systems. Because if we start putting them in place now, and they're already in place in a lot of areas. I mean, if we look at what you're doing here, this is a parallel system. Millennial is now part of our culture. It is an institution, much the same as the BBC programs used to be. We now have our own section, our own parallel systems. We have our own parallel news. We have our own. So all of this alternative media is a parallel. There's still the legacy media. It's still there. The BBC's still there. ITV's still there. The newspapers are still on the shelves in the supermarkets. But there is something else that runs alongside it, which is Twitter or X. There is Telegram. There is YouTube. There is all of these other things where people now get their news, entertainment, comedy, all of this stuff. So it's a parallel. And we need to start doing that in all areas. It's been a really good year, right, for my organization, the Woodlander Initiative, for Return to the Land in America, for Free Sweden in Sweden, for Urania in South Africa, and to hear of literally hundreds of smaller groups doing the same thing below the radar, right across the globe. It has been really, really encouraging. And it's not just about buying land. It's about starting businesses. It's about retaining culture. It's about rebuilding culture. Because what's happened over the last 10, 20 years is that our culture hasn't stayed the same. It's been eroded and it started to be replaced with something worse than. And you can see that in music, and you can see that in literature, that the things pushed to the front that become everyday, commonplace, are not better than what we used to have. So our everyday culture becomes much worse. You could say that now it's a cultural norm to wear a stab vest when visiting London. Do you know what I mean? This is not a good thing, okay? But that this is what becomes a cultural norm. It is being imposed by outside forces. So all of these parallel structures give us the opportunity to retain our own culture and build upon it, rebuild it to where we want it to be. So we retain our heritage, we retain our culture. And we can only do that through parallel structures. We can't do it through the system that we're forced to live in. This multicultural system, right, does not work for us. So it's been a really good year to see these parallel groups, America, Sweden, Germany, South Africa, and Britain, really coming to the fore, really getting people involved. And talking to these people, I spoke with Dan Erickson this year. I've spoken to Arvel quite a few times.
Both of those are exemplary guys, in my opinion. I really liked having Arvel on last year and Dan Erickson this year. Tremendous, great work.
And they've got the right idea, which is, listen, if the culture we're living in and the system we're forced to live in, if it doesn't work for us and we can't vote our way out of this, we can't vote for someone who's going to change it, then what we do is we start building a system that we want to live in for ourselves. We buy land. We cultivate it, we grow our own food, we keep our own livestock, we build houses where we can live, we build communities of people like us, and we start again, and we're careful who we let in, and we're careful about how we interact. But this has grown massively in the last year, so it's been a positive year in that respect. It's bigger than I thought it was because there's lots of people doing it who don't make a big song and dance. They're doing it quietly in the background. They've bought 50 acres. They've built 20 homes. They've got a community. They're now duplicating that because they know it works. What we've got to do now is look at what things we can bolt onto this. So it's not just land. It's businesses. It's healthcare. It's all the other bits that come with it. So it's food's a massive one, especially in the UK. Our farming industry, someone's made a decision somewhere in a back room that Britain will not be a food-producing country. And they are literally closing down the farmers. The farmers know this as well. I mean, if you speak to them, they will tell you. There's decisions that have been made in either Davos or in the EU. Someone has made a decision that we're not going to be farming in this country. And they're hitting us at every single opportunity. They're passing laws which say we've got to give over 20% of our land to rewilding. If you do that to a farmer, you've just knocked off 20% of his income. Now, when you look at their profit margins, that's what they were living on. So now he can't live. And they just make this law. They say, no, that's what you're doing. And then you struggle through, and they hit you with an inheritance tax, which says that, by the way, when you die, you're going to have to sell the farm because you're going to get hit with this huge tax bill. They then line up Vanguard and BlackRock to buy all the farms anyway. Or the farmer thinks, I'm just going to have to diversify then. There's no money in this. What I can do is put some wind farms up or solar farms up. And we've got no farming land. We've got no food. And you look at people like Amazon, who are now talking about getting into the food distribution network, opening up huge warehouses in the UK, where you'll be able to order your food instead of from Tesco's, you can get it from Amazon, it will be delivered to your door the next day. Same as anything else. But it won't be from the UK. The salad will come from Spain, and your oranges will come from wherever. But the UK won't be growing its own food. So if we want to preserve that, we've got to work with the farmers, find a way around it. Now, we are doing at the moment, working, getting the farmers growing their food and getting it straight to the public instead of through supermarkets. And it's kind of working quite well. Excuse me. But we need to do more of it. And as we create businesses, we need to use them. This is probably going to be the hardest thing, right, to get through to people is, okay, we can do all of this. Right? This one of our guys, he starts a business. He's making, I don't know, jam, something we all have on our toast in the morning. And no one buys it. None of us buy it. Because we're still going to Tesco's. And we're all guilty of this. So his business goes under. Or he's struggling. Yeah. But what we've got to do is start shaming people in the end then, just because if our guys start a business, right, and it doesn't matter what it is, if it's if they write a play and put a play on, we should go and see it. But we should go and support the people in our network that are doing things. And we don't
absolutely
do that.
We should be keeping our money within the movement and as much as possible, getting money from outside. And this is why I find it quite amusing to the idea of making stuff that progressives will buy so that we get their money. And then we can, then that's within our ecosystem. And then we use that money to buy things from each other. And I think there need to be directories. There need to be networks where you can easily find what you need sold by one of our guys.
It's been difficult in previous years because the minute a sort of a nationalist directory of business, people were scared to go on it. You put your name up there, right, you're going to get, you'll be in hope, not hate, or you'll be, written up in the newspaper, or your name would be thrown about. But there are plenty of ways to do it. If it's done properly, So that's something we're looking at, is how can we do this, right? Because we need everything. Right? We need to keep the money in our group, with our people, and we need to promote our business people. This is where real power comes from. You know, it's not politicians. The most powerful people in the world aren't politicians. Elon Musk is not a politician. Okay, he's just very, very wealthy. So we need to grow our wealth. No one's going to do these things for us. How do we do that? We support our people. And we're not doing it. We're really, really not doing it. And it kind of annoys me, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Lord Powell.
Before we go into that, let me just say this. I think you're absolutely right, and I agree with you. But I think that the British people, the general British public, like the idea of farmers and farming because it's so cute and sort of old-fashioned, and yet it remains absolutely necessary and healthy and right to grow food, to produce the basic, the rudiments of a meal. This stuff is just inherently is appealing and nice and reassuring to people, as it should be. And, you know, I remember seeing this leftist on Twitter or somewhere, and I thought it was like the epitome of someone who's been, well, deracinated, just torn away from common sense and from truth and from timeless wisdom. And he was saying that farmers don't do anything. You know, it's easy. It's easy being a farmer. You don't have to do anything. And I thought, how on earth can you say those words? I mean, how can you believe that? Do you really believe that? Are you just saying it for effect? Do you just want to save face? But you're prepared to say something utterly insane like that. I mean, it's a huge amount of work to be a farmer. It's one of the most arduous jobs you could have.
I mean, I live right in the middle of like a real big farming area. This evening, I was out with the family at a tractor and tinsel event for Christmas. They do it every year. Hundreds of farmers get involved, flashing lights all over the tractors. They drive them through the town. All the kids love it. It's brilliant. I know quite a lot of farmers. It's hard work, right? And they are literally the backbone of this country. They'll be the first to agree that government interference really doesn't work in farming. Do you know what I mean? They would be quite happy to see some of the subsidies go and do it off their own back. It's a difficult one. The annoying thing is, and I spoke to a group a couple of months ago. In the 1980s, we were producing around 80% of our own food, which is good. With a little bit of work and a little bit of encouragement from the government, we could have hit 100% quite easily in the 90s. They went the opposite direction. It went down and down and down and down, and now it's around between 40 and 50%. And everything else comes from abroad. Which is diabolical. The one thing we should be self-sufficient in is our own food. Especially when you consider it's completely possible to do it. It's completely possible. So,
This is just such common sense. And again, I think the British public like the idea of self-sufficiency. A town being self-sufficient, self-contained, it's got everything it needs. It's a nice idea. It's a cute idea. And I think that sounds trivial, but I think that really excites people. It appeals to them. So it shouldn't be a hard sell. And absolutely, I mean, I would want it to be 90, 95%, because I know that there are imports that are, I mean, I like Parmesan, for example. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's got their foreign vice, the thing that they like from abroad. But leaving that aside, of course, we should try to be as self-sufficient in food and in pharmaceuticals, medical supplies, as we possibly can be, because at any time we could fall out with, you know, it's obvious. And in recent years, it has seemed that, you know, with China and Russia, that the globalist system might be breaking down, the trade routes getting blocked, countries cutting ties and so on. Again, it's like a clarion call. Stop relying on other countries to provide you with these essentials.
The minute you fall out with them, you've got yourself. No essentials.
Yeah,
it is common sense.
It's the most basic, fundamental common sense. It's about survival.
Look, from my point of view, I mean, I went off grid, and because I didn't want to be reliant on the system. So I provide my own electricity. I'm not reliant on an electricity board and my own food and my own, you know, water supply. So it's, and I haven't got a mortgage, so I'm not paying into a bank. I've built my own house. For me, if I can do it, then others can do it. So you end up with a self-sufficient community, which sounds quite clever to me. If you can all get together and you can all do bits and pieces and you can help each other out, you've got community, you start growing some food, you keep a bit of livestock, you work with your local farmer as well, right? And he produces stuff which you purchase. Now you've got a proper little village going, right? And that's really what we're after. That's what we're after doing. Like I said, there are things that we need to concentrate on. We need to look at healthcare is one of them. You mentioned pharmaceuticals. I've had talks with organizations that have well over 1,000 doctors, surgeons, dentists who are all willing to work outside of the system. So these things are being put in place. And all of these parallel systems are going to have to be in place, because when the public actually realise what's happening, they'll be looking for an alternative. And there's no point trying to put it together in 5 years' time or in 10 years' time. What you need to be able to do is say, look, we've already done it. We've already got the basics down, and we're just waiting for you to come along, the engineer, and help us with this bit. We're helping you, the nurse, to come along, you, the school teacher, right? You're the missing piece. And that's how you grow it. I've been absolutely blown away from the members that we've got in the initiative. Come from every walk of life. I've just mentioned teachers, engineers, doctors, police officers, like everyone from every walk of life, and each bring those skills into a community, and it works absolutely brilliantly, because we're all on the same page and we all want the same thing, and we all understand, right, what we don't want. We don't want to be living in a multicultural, right, technocracy. It doesn't work. It's going to be horrible. And if you don't want that, and you can't vote for a party that's going to make changes, what you have to do is start building it yourself. The problem arises that most people are lazy. They don't want to do that. They just want it better. So we're going to have to build it for other people as well. And that's the truth of it. Most people will not get involved until it's fully formed and they can walk straight in. And that's fine. But we do have to understand that.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, you'll be banging your head against a wall. If you don't accept human nature as it is, you find yourself at war with human nature, and it's a war you're going to lose. So, yeah, I agree. It's annoying. It's really annoying, but you've just got to accept it and deal with the reality. Okay, so let's get on to the this year for the Woodlander Initiative, since I think it probably connects to a lot of what you've been saying. And I just want to say that I agree with if there's not a single word that I would take issue with in what you've said. I'm much less practical than you. I'm not as much of a doer as you are, but it very much appeals to me, and I approve of it.
This parallel society, parallel systems, right, encompasses everything, right? And I'm not knocking the online world, right, at all, because we need it. And I'm not knocking anyone who says, well, you know, I can't build anything, or I can't grow this, or, you know, I couldn't ever do that. That's brilliant. But everybody has got a skill. And I know that yours is writing, right, and political commentary and social commentary. And these things are important. These things are important, and we need our own people to be doing it and to be giving our point of view. That's what a parallel system, a parallel society is having our own guys building our own systems. Brilliant. Imperium Press, we have our own publishers. Half-Fire Radio, we have our own channels for pagans and what. All of these different avenues, right, are guides. The only thing, before I get onto the Woodlander thing, I'm going to keep hammering this. The only thing that really annoys me is we don't support them. People just do not support our own people in business. When they start something up, people go, yep, that's absolutely great, and they don't do it. The biggest one for me was Laura Towler started a tea company, right, because Yorkshire Tea said, we don't want any far-right people buying our tea anyway. Okay, she said, fine, I'll start my own tea company. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And people still go down Tesco's and buy tea from there instead of from our people. And that's horrible. That is horrible. That's like if you opened a cafe and you watch your mum and dad and your brother walk past and go to the cafe up the road. How would you feel? If our people start a business, use it. Yes, it's inconvenient. Yes, it might cost you £2 more. Use it. Right? If you don't, then these people fail. Right? And it's down to us. So I keep hammering it because it's important. Right? It really is important. Yes. People should be supporting you, right, doing what you're doing tonight. Send a tenner, keep it going, right? It's massively important to do 60 interviews, so much information, right, for our people to listen to, for our people to learn from. Support it. So now I'll get on to the Woodlander Initiative. Okay, it's been a good year, right? It has been a really, really good year. I spent most of it doing what I hate, which is the administrative and legal side. But it was a side that needed to be done. We have an excellent legal team who were willing to work with us, who understood what we were doing, that we were buying land, building community.
Just before you go into this, I want to underline this. You couldn't have a legal team if you didn't have money. And this is, again, is why funding things is so important, because otherwise it's over. You just can't, you can't have lawyers if you can't pay them. So then you just have to give up. It would just be, a clock ticking. Okay, we're just going to have to pack this all in, whether we do it now or a year from now, it's gone. The only defense is, ultimately funding in almost everything. Obviously, it comes down to also human effort and commitment, but that only goes so far in the real world. So I just wanted to make that point. You couldn't have a legal team if people weren't supporting you. So please go
ahead. I'll touch on that because it is massively important. What we realized from the start is what we needed to do. Okay. For any endeavor that we wanted to do, we were going to need land. So if we wanted a building, we were going to have to put that on land. If we wanted to grow food for ourselves to eat, we were going to need land. If we wanted to, anything we wanted, we were going to need that. So to buy that is really, really expensive. So there was no point in me saying, okay, I'm going to buy 50 plots of land throughout the whole country, because I couldn't afford it. But collectively, by working as a collective, as a group of homogenous people, right, and everyone putting in a little bit, we've now got a lot of money, and now we all benefit from it. That actually took quite a while for people to understand. Their first question was, okay, what's in it for me? And I was turning people away, said, do you know what? This probably isn't for you. If that's the way you're thinking, it's probably not for you. Because, yes, you will get benefit from it, but what the question you need to be asking is, what's in it for us? What is in this for us? And then it becomes really, really worthwhile. Because when we all benefit, we all benefit. So it's collective. No one's got a spare couple of million in our group. Right, but by working together, it's actually not that difficult. 1,000 people puts in £1,000. You've got yourself a million. And with £1 million, you can start to do a lot of good for our people. So it's working as a collective. It's collectivizing. So the legal team, really hard on ensuring that our members were safe. It became apparent that people like Hope Not Hate don't like us much, and would, if they could, start doxing people who were involved. So we've ensured that membership details cannot be found. That was important to us, that our members were safe. As important was, as you grow an organization, you get to 1,000 members and, you know, then several thousand, you're going to get some people in there with a checkered history. We understand that. If groups like Hope Not Hate or Searchlight can get hold of details, not only do they dox the people, but they use their checkered history to then attack the organization. And we've seen this before. They say, this is what, you know, millennial woes club's all about. See this bloke here? He's, you know, he punched someone in the head in 1976. And this bloke here stole a car. So suddenly your organization is just full of criminals. It's not. 2,000 people, and they pick two that have got a checkered history. So it was important that we could safeguard that from happening. And the other thing that people were worried about was compulsory purchase of the land we buy, that the government would just say, okay, we can't touch them legally. Everything's set up above board. We'll just take their land. We'll steal it and give them a pittance for it. So we've set that up now, and the legal team looked at the best. To be honest, that can never be 100% safe, because they can't always do it. But they can make it really, really difficult for the state. So they've set up a trust. The land is passed from the company to a trust. The beneficiaries of the trust are the members of the club. So instead of trying to steal a company's assets, they've now got to deal with over 1,000 members individually, which is quite difficult for them. And then we had to look at if they said that our organization was some sort of extremist group, they could seize the assets, which they did recently to a record company in the UK. They said, well, you're producing extremist material, so we're going to seize your assets. So the legal team worked with us to make sure that that couldn't happen as well. So it's been a long year working on the legals, but the membership has steadily risen. We restructured the whole organization. We restructured the whole website. We've got some incredible people working on that. So just a quick salute to Dan and Paul and Reagan, thank you very much for your hard work, guys. And I say that because it's something I could never do myself. I don't understand technology like that. And they've done an incredible thing. The website's brilliant now. And it's much easier for members to get involved. So that whole side of it, the legal side, the restructuring side, and the website side is all done and done by the end of this year. And it coincided with the purchase of our third large plot of land in the southeast of England, of all places, which is probably one of the most expensive. But we had a good group in the southeast, and they were keen to get a piece of land there. So we've bought the third plot, and that's being used at the moment and being cleared and a road being built. And yeah, I mean, it's an exciting time. It's an exciting time for us. There's things going on the meadow in Wales. That's working well. We've got another woodland in Wales as well, where work's progressing there. So bit by bit, we're getting bigger and bigger. And it's headed in the right direction. What I've been encouraged by is not just our membership, but is the feedback. When I get round to talking to the people. So I'll give you an example. We had a weekend in Wales where we all got together. We had a barbecue. We did some work. We took a barn down and moved it down further down the lane. And it was a really good weekend. And I was speaking to one of the mothers. And she said to me, do you know what? I've come for this weekend. I get on great with everyone. I've gone to bed at 10 o'clock every night because I'm knackered. And she brought a daughter with her who's early teens. And she said, I've left my daughter out till 2 o'clock in the morning. I've just gone to bed. She said, you have no idea what it's like, right, to be able to do that. I have absolutely no worries. All the kids were out playing on rope swings, and, you know, we set up some tire swings for them. They even managed to find one spot in the meadow where they could get a signal on their phone, so they all crowded around there because all teenagers. But they were just left to do their own thing, but in a safe environment. And she said, I can't do that at home. I can't go to bed at 10 and leave my daughter out. So to be able to come to a place like this in a community of people that I know, like, and trust, she said, it is priceless. So we've rebuilt a high-trust society within a year.
That's great. It's terrific. That's what I was going to say, is that this is what we all miss. I mean, every time I go back home, I'm amazed that there are no kids around, because we used to just play out in the street. And that's not that long ago. I mean, what, 25 years ago. And it just doesn't happen now. It's like there's been a real cultural change. And someone explained to me, a parent said to me, yeah, kids do still play, but it's in controlled environments where there's an adult watching them. At all times, and they don't. There's no spontaneous play anymore, or just socializing. It's always in a something that's been set up for that purpose. I mean, it's a very strange age we're living.
But that's what we've got to get away from. This is what I mentioned earlier when I said it's not just about retaining your culture; it's about rebuilding it to what it should be. Because it's changed in ways that aren't necessarily good. So we've got to start getting back to basics, back to a high-trust society. And we know how to do that, right? And we know where it's gone wrong. So we just make sure we never make the same mistakes. And this country being what it is, with its rules, regulations, and laws, they don't make it easy to do what we're doing. Okay, but it is possible. And it does start small when people say, oh, you've only bought 3 plots of land so far. We have only bought 3 and we want 50. So we've got a long way to go. And people say, well, why do you want 50? It's because we understand human nature. If we were to buy one huge plot in the north of England, the people in the south would never go there because they just wouldn't. They wouldn't travel. And if I bought one in the southwest, then the people in the north wouldn't go there because people don't like to travel. But if we have a plot in every single county, really there is no excuse. And it makes it much easier for people to use. And then you can grow from there. You can say, okay, we've got the land here which you can use, and we've got some land here that we can build on. We can actually put a conference centre on this one, and we've got some land over there that we've got some housing on. And all of this is possible if you know what you're doing. It's a minefield, the planning laws and legislation, but all of these things are possible, and they're all being done. We're now looking at buying a working farm. So we've got several members who want to run a farm. They come from that background. They've got a little bit of money. They want us to come in with them. And we want to buy a working farm. Now, that farm would be a fantastic hub because it wouldn't just be the farmhouse and the farm growing arable crops and vegetable crops and some livestock. It would be a hub. So we could convert some of the farm buildings to a conference center or a media center. We can put temporary housing on for our members who would be working on the farm. So we've got housing now, and it'd be a showcase. It'd be somewhere we could take the public and say, come and have a look, this is what we're doing, right? Come and meet the scary monsters, and they can see that actually these guys are doing good work. And that counts for a lot. The farm's going to cost a lot of money. We're probably going to be looking at £500,000. But I'm confident that we'll get down there in the following year, this coming year. That's what I'm going to be pushing for, is more land and to buy the first farm. Because once we've got that, we've got a showcase, we've got a hub where we could all get to. We can start growing our own food properly. We've got a business that we can actually support. And it gives us that showcase to bring people to and say, come and have a look. Come and meet some of the people.
And it's something tangible as well. You can then say, we have got our farm.
Yes.
It's not, but we've got lots of land on which something could happen. It's actually a farm. That's great.
Yeah. Even already, I mean, I gave a speech 2 years ago to Patriotic Alternative. I was asked to go and give a speech, and it was only short. It was 15 minutes, and I didn't know if they were going to throw me out of a window afterwards, because what I actually did is I went through every right-wing organisation in the last 90 years and pointed out that every single one of those organisations, their aim was to change things. And they were going to do that through the political route. And every single one of them had failed. It's not very nice to be told that. But every single one failed. And on top of that, I asked, where is the BUF library? Where is the National Front Sports Centre? Where is the BNP college? Where are these things? They don't exist, because every penny from every organisation for 90 years was put into electioneering and it failed. And this is why I've been saying the party political route at the moment in the climate we're in is not for us. We need to build community first, and then we need to look at parallel systems where we can grow our incomes, we can grow our wealth, and we can start putting in structures where we're at least safe. And then we can go from there. But without that, we're on the back foot, and all we're going to be doing is throwing money exactly the same that every other organization has done, and we'll end up nowhere. Already in 2 years, we have more assets, right, solid assets, than any other right-wing organization in 2 years. And that's simply because instead of putting it into printing leaflets and to go into elections or buying banners and flags, we're putting it into buying land and working with the legal team to make sure that the members are safe, the company's safe, the structure's safe, so that as we move forward and start looking at housing and providing housing for our people, okay, in an affordable manner, it's all above board, it's all safe, and people will know, right, these are the guys you need to go and see. There's a lot we can do, right, and there's a lot moving forward. I'm sure we will be asked to do more things. I've just been impressed with the people who got involved so far. I couldn't have done any of this without them. The people who built the website, the members that do the hard work down on the land. These guys took a whole barn down and then moved it sort of half a mile up the lane, right, all by hand. All by hand. I mean, I couldn't do it. I'm like only 3 years away from being 60 years old. Do you know what I mean? Those heavy lifting days are gone by me. But to see our members, these young lads, right, to come down there, and their first question is, what can I do to help? Give me something to do. It's really good.
And that's great. That's terrific. It sounds like it's really going well, and there are lots of reasons for optimism, lots of positive and real achievements as well, and laying the groundwork for future achievements. And I think the main thing there is longevity. People use the term future-proofing nowadays. Building resilience so that there can't be some unforeseen attack from the government, basically.
Yeah.
So I think this is all extremely important.
The whole parallel thing is to not be reliant on any way on that on the governmental system. So that no matter what happens, it's got to be put in legally, which we spent all the time doing that. But we want to build our own thing. How big it gets is really down to the people that help us, the members that join, right, and the people who say, do you know what, I'm in another country, but what you're doing is fantastic, we'll help, we'll donate a little bit. Because it does come down to money at the end of the day. Our members are putting in money every single week, right, every single week, because they all understand, if I put in a little bit, if I put in £5, right, which is next to nothing, doesn't do anything. But if 100 of us put in £5, we've got £500. We've just bought a quad with that. Now we can actually pull stuff around the field. So it's...
And if 500 people, if 100 people put in £5 a month,
yes,
then in a year it really adds up.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be massive amounts. Now, we'd obviously quite like it if someone came along and said, we like what you're doing, here's £1 million. It would just... But it doesn't change what we're doing. It just means we can get it done faster.
Yeah.
The direction we're going is dead right. I'm absolutely confident of that. I can't see any way that there isn't going to be... In America, it's going to be balkanization. And in this country, there's going to be a societal split. And I think it's going to be... ethno-nationalists, people who understand heritage and identity, and everybody else. I think a lot of people will be quite happy living in a 20-minute neighborhood surrounded by Somalians and Pakistanis. And If they're quite happy to live like that, that's fine. I'm not going to take that away from them. If that's what they want, brilliant. But if I don't want that, I should be allowed to go a separate route and build my own way. And the freedom freedom of association says I can do that. And anyone who wants to come with me and live a different way, they'll be entitled to. So I think that split's going to happen. I think it will be about halfway through Farage's tenure, because people will understand that he's not going to change anything. And we can't keep on doing the same thing. I don't believe Betts is correct. I don't believe there's going to be a civil war. So the only thing we've got is stop waiting for someone else to do this stuff for you. Get involved and we can build it ourselves. If I can do it as a single person, then other people can do it. And if other people can do it, we've got a community. And if we've got a community, we can build a village. And eventually people are going to be looking at that village and saying, well, how come they've got no crime? And how come they're all happy? And how come they can feed themselves when I can't afford to go and buy food? And it's because you get back to basics, a homogenous village with a farm. It doesn't take rocket science, does it? And everyone has a job in their place and everybody helps each other. We all remember this. We all know this. Let's just get it done. Let's do it. Instead of talking about it and saying how nice it would be, I mean, even academic agent, I told him the other day, his peak was Trumpton. He came up with this idea, okay, but we've got the Trumpton village and this man's got the, and everyone poo-pooed the idea. And I said, it's the best thing. It's the best thing. Right? Because
I completely agreed with him about that.
Yeah.
In fact, I made an amusing meme, which I don't think he liked it very much, but it was affectionate. So I'll put it up here just now.
Yeah.
I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
Because he was saying about people in the know will get it. But anyway, there we are. But yeah, I agree. Trumpton, and he did a lovely video talking about analyzing an episode of Trumpton. And it was great. I wish he'd done more of those.
He did.
That is what we want to get back to.
Yes. And I mean, it ties in again, once again, Colin, to the speech you gave, which struck so many chords with me, which was a self-sufficient village. No large town, right? But there would be, I think you said one, but I think we could probably stretch to a couple of metropolis, one in the north and maybe one in the south. And maybe one large town for every 20 villages. But we could deconstruct these towns, these horrible architectural carbuncles, and build properly and build villages, quaint English villages, right, where we could live. All we've got to do first is get Steve Law's remigration going. We've got a smaller population. We've got somewhere beautiful to live. We've got self-sufficiency in our food and our energy. We're sat on coal, which can last us another millennia, and North Sea oil. Let's start using it. Okay, we don't have to blight the landscape with solar and wind turbines. If you're going to use solar, put it on the roof of houses or buildings. It doesn't need to be in fields. It makes no sense whatsoever. Apart from it means you can't farm that land, which is why they've done it. There's so many things we can do, but the only way to show people is to build it first. So we're starting now.
Yeah, to be the example that they can then follow and be inspired, be energized by. I think that's so important.
Yeah.
Because people, it's so easy to say something. I think people love to see that this actually can happen. This can be done because someone else has done it.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? It's like people looked at my YouTube channel and they were like, I can't believe you've done that. You bought some woodland and you built a four-bedroom cabin and you live off-grid. That's incredible. And, you know, fine, but you could do it. And I got so many excuses. Well, I could never do that. I didn't build... I'd never even put a shelf up before I built this place. I made loads of mistakes. Do you know what I mean? But I just got on and done it. So people can do things. And it is seeing it that spurs people on. I've had a lot of people, I've helped 20, 25 people do exactly the same. And they did it because they saw I'd done it. So that works. And this whole build a village, it works like the minute we start building it. Every time we get members on to get together and bring a couple of our members, bring that they always join. They have a weekend there. They're like, what you've done is incredible. We can see where this is going. They join. When people see it, I could sell people on the idea. The idea is easy. I just spoke about it just a minute ago. Self-sufficient village. We can build a really quaint, deconstruct those horrible towns to metropolis where people can go off to do, you know, science and technology. But they can always come back to that village, which won't change. It doesn't need to change. Why would it? I can sell people on the idea, but now they want to taste it. Now they want to see it. Now they want to go there. So that's where we've got to get to. The only way we're going to get there, right, is with a few more members, right, and people saying, do you know what you're doing is worthwhile. I'll get involved. I'll back it. I'll help you. We don't stop anyone joining, right, from our side. I don't care if you're a member of someone else's political party. We're not a political party. Anyone can join. Get involved, right, come along. Bring your wife and kids, have a great weekend when we have get-togethers, have a barbecue, see what we're doing, help us out. Everyone's got skills that can be used.
Yeah, definitely. Everyone's got a contribution to make, for sure. I think a lot of people just need to make that leap. I think a lot of people would have a lot of stuff to give and a lot of time to give, but... yeah, there's always trepidation at first. We should get to the super chats now, and we can summarize all of that at the end. I want to do that, but we'll do the super chats here and now. Streaky Bacon said, thanks, Woz, for another end of the year NatFest. You're welcome. Thank you. Dardy said, evening, gentlemen. Wondering if Woodlander could provide an update on his initiative to purchase green spaces in Britain. I remember it being one of the highlights of Millennial last year. Thank you. Well, I think we've done that. So I hope that was sufficient. Thank you. The Wanderer. With the abolition of jury trials, courtesy of Lord Leveson and Spammy Lammy, push for digital ID no one asked for, and Starmer's insistence that no local elections shall occur in May, hasn't the regime entered cocoon mode, lockstep with absurd calls for a hot war with Russia? Cheers. It amuses me. Trigonometry and Sargon now bleat about Fuentes to stay relevant. Well, yeah, let's leave that last bit out of it. And yeah, your summary, do you think that the regime has entered cocoon mode and is pushing for war with Russia? And hello to your doggy, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Can you see him? They are pushing for war. And this happens a lot when systems are nearing collapse, which I think this one's on teetering on the edge. I spoke earlier about what happens if immigration stays the same and technology does what it should do, then financially this country's knackered. But it's not just the UK, right? It's Germany, it's France, it's Sweden. They're all on the same trajectory, which is, you know, if there's no jobs, the government can't tax you. And if the government can't tax you, how's it going to pay for things? And so the whole system's kind of in this flux. But what they are making sure, before anything either collapses or changes, is they've got the legislation in place now, right, to shut you down. You can be arrested for what you're thinking. I'm unbelievable as that sounds, I mean, Sam Melia was arrested and imprisoned for over 2 years for what the judge believed he was thinking. That was it. Nothing he did broke the law.
Oh, it was outrageous. Absolutely outrageous.
So, yes, they are pushing for war because it takes everybody's mind off of what is actually happening. It gets rid of a load of angry young men, as we know, and it makes certain groups billions and billions of pounds, dollars, shekels.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, I mean, that is, it's. I don't like skirting over that to go to the next super chat because it's such a significant thing that you just said. But that does seem to be what's happening. The system is falling apart, and so its solution is to just launch a war with a major power that I don't think we could possibly win. So it's kind of suicidal. But I guess they'd rather that than admit that this current situation is unsustainable.
Yeah.
Unless they've got some trick up their sleeve where we could, you know, just destroy Russia somehow. But I just don't see that. I mean, maybe, I don't know, is it just for the sake of the G-ing up the public, but they don't actually mean it. They don't actually intend to really go to war. I've no idea. It just doesn't make any sense to me. Okay, and the Wanderer also said, Britain's farmers do need their own Eva Vlaardingerbroek. She's the Dutch beauty that everyone will be familiar with. Please offer Woodlander this white pill. A century ago, Gerard Wallop, Rolf Gardner, and Harold Massingham got together and formed Kinship and Husbandry, which directly led to the Soil Association in 1946. Precedent is there. Godspeed the plough. There we go. Thank you, Wanderer. Don said, thank you, our Woody. That's Don Browning. You might be familiar with her from Twitter. All right.
I've known Don from the Scrubs.
Ah, yes, of course, from
Dangerfield.
Yeah. Okay, and then Dardy said, although I don't live in Britain, it gives me immense joy to hear that there are positive things happening there. As corny as this sounds, in order to save the West, we have to first save Britain. Well, I think you might be right, unless there's going to be a West that doesn't have Britain in it, because Britain's become an Islamified hellhole. But I don't think so. I think we will resurge and save this country. Okay. Any final words, Woodlander?
Colin, thank you very much for having me on. I know how important it is that you get new people on each year. So just to come back, it's always an honour for me to talk on here. And to have anyone listening, it is great. What I would say is check out the Woodlander Initiative website, have a look through it, and help out if you can. Even if you don't want to join, right, you can donate and you can offer skills or expertise in some area. The quicker we get this done, the quicker we can build an alternative, and it is going to be needed. We're going to great guns, and like I said, the coming year, I'm hoping to get that farm nailed down. That's really what I'm going to be pushing for. I think that would do us the world of good.
Yeah, so do I. I think you're providing vital leadership here. And I really commend what you're doing. And I think I said this last year as well, but I say it again. I think this is just crucial, what's going on here with the Woodlander Initiative. I think it's a brilliant idea, and I want everyone to support it in whatever ways they can. So good luck with the farm, but good luck in general with the initiative next year. I think it's terrific. Yeah, so, okay, good luck. I'll be back in a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes. I need to get something to eat with the next guest. But in the meantime, Woodlander, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025. All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.